And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
In my recent article about diversification and the podcast, I talked about time diversification and the use of dollar cost averaging into an investment, which by default means you're not going to put all of your money in at the bottom and you're not going to put all your money in at the top. I've got lots of emails in response to that saying, wait a minute, Paul. You evidently haven't read the research that shows, and boy, does it, that you are better off to invest whatever money you have to invest right now, that the odds are you're going to do better over the long term if you put it to work in equities today. Not a month from now, not over the years, but right now. And I don't deny that that is the outcome of making that decision. I would say the same thing about stocks versus bonds, that you're going to make more money over a lifetime investing in stocks as a group, not necessarily one by one, that's a whole different set of probabilities, but as a group, you will make more off of the equity part of your portfolio than the fixed income. And when you look at the long-term returns of $100 since 1928, we find that with the small cap value, an asset class I've talked a lot about, that $100 would have grown to $7.5 million. If you put it in the S&P 500, it would have grown to about $458,000. So the evidence is small cap value is better than large cap blend, overwhelmingly. On the other hand, I would not take offense if somebody challenged me and said, wait a minute, Paul, there are a lot of people who believe that the unit of return with the S&P 500 is going to be a lot less risky and more dependable to give a decent return as opposed to the small cap value having more risk, and maybe you'll get the great return and maybe you won't. But we can look at 40-year periods. We know what the average 40-year period is for small cap value going back to 1928. The average, putting $100 into the small cap value index over 40 years is over $40,000. In the S&P 500, the average is about $6,400. So I could go on and on, you know, loading you up with numbers to convince you this is what you should do. On the other hand, almost everybody I know in the industry says that the right thing to do, not what we know historically is the best thing to do, but the right thing to do is to diversify amongst large and small and value and growth. And in fact, the total market index at Vanguard for the U.S. market does have a small piece of small cap value. It's about 3% of the portfolio. And I said, great, they do believe in having small cap value in the portfolio. Maybe it's because of that amazing long-term track record that they have a small part of the portfolio in small cap value. And I'm just saying that from where I'm sitting, I want to see more than 3% in small cap value. But there's a large part of the market and the advisors and the experts who say, no, you're better off matching, if you will, the market to the size of companies. So if small cap value companies represent 3% of all of the public equities in the United States, that's how much we should have in small cap value. Other people will say, now let's spread it evenly among large and small and value and growth and REITs and internationals. It'll go, you know, more and more diversification. But we do know, bottom line, from everything I can see and find about the past is small cap value. If you want to go for the gold ring, you would put your money there and just leave it. No market timing, just leave it. Add money over time in that same asset class, just put it in there every month. Dollar cost averaging every month as you put money into your 401k. I know that is what the textbooks could show you that show the returns on the that particular asset class. But I happen to agree with all of those people who say that probably you shouldn't depend on that one asset class, even though it has performed as well as it has over 90 plus years now. So that would, in theory, be the right thing to do, to put it all in small cap value, but the wrong thing to do, because people say, "Ooh, I don't know if I can really trust all that historical information to serve you in that way." And there are a lot of decisions that we recommend to do differently than what is absolutely in your best interest based on the past. The question of how much in stocks and how much in bonds. I mean, I know that if I could figure out how to make you an extra half of 1% a year, that for anybody who puts away $5,000 a year for 40 years into a 401k and can add an extra 0.5%, it could legitimately give you an extra $2 million to spend and to leave to others. So how much would it be worth to you to go from, let's say, a return of about 8.8% versus a return of 10.1% for the rest of your saving and investing years, getting prepared to retire and start taking money out of your portfolio? Well, where did the 8.8% come from? That's the return of the S&P 500 from 1970 through 2018. And in a portfolio that's half in bonds and half in the S&P 500. And the bonds are basically intermediate-term bonds, so they're not high-risk bonds. And that difference, then, between 8.8 and 10.1 is not a half a percent. In fact, it's 1.3% a year difference over that 49-year period. And where did that difference come from? Well, the S&P 500 is more volatile than the fixed income. And you would, therefore, if you had all your money in stocks, have to periodically, in fact, over this particular 49-year period, there were three times that you would have lost over half of your money. So the industry rightfully says, wait a minute, you know, maybe you don't need to make 10.1% to get where you're trying to go. Maybe you need to find a way to put your portfolio together that it brings the risk down, and it's also going to bring the return down. That's the way it happens. And that gives you target date funds. Because when we look at target date funds going back to 1970, and when I say when we look at target date funds, we can't see a target date fund that goes back to 1970, but what we can see is a lookalike of the combination of asset classes that, for example, Vanguard would use to manage a target date fund from 1970 through 2018. So what do we know? Well, we know that you would get about an 8% return, because over the years, as you get older, they'll start adding bonds, and the older you are, the more bonds they're going to have in your portfolio. In fact, by the time you're 75, as I am at Vanguard, you're going to have 30% in equities, and 70% is going to be in fixed income. even though you would have made more money. I would have made more money if I hadn't added bonds to my portfolio. So I don't have any problem with the fact that an all-equity portfolio is going to lead to higher rates of return over the long term. But it is very difficult to find somebody who's willing to recommend to their clients that you're better to have all your money in stocks than having part of your money in bonds. But the fact is they are likely right for talking people out of doing what would probably create the highest return for them, because the emotional response to a bear market can wipe people out, can literally cut their return over a lifetime in half. And that's because even though there's reams of evidence that stocks as a group do better than bonds over the long term, at the moment they're going through that, that's not what their brain is telling them. Remember, there's a part of our brain that likes to solve problems very quickly, intuitively. And then there's another part of our brain that's more logical, intellectual, thinks more slowly. Well, when it comes to money, sex, and food, a lot of those decisions are not in the slow part of our decision-making brain, but is in fact in that more intuitive, emotional part of the brain. And so we rightly are recommending that people like myself have saved enough to retire as long as nothing catastrophic happens. And so here I am at 75 with half my money in bonds and half my money in stocks. And would my children and charities, would they end up with more if I just stayed all in stocks? Yep, they probably would. But I'm addressing for me, and I'm addressing for a lot of you, that there's an emotional side that may never let us actually achieve what the market had there for us to make. And so these forks in the road that I have to give guidance on, and you have to yourself make decisions for you and your family, it is about the numbers from the past, but it's also about the emotion that people go through depending how much money they're investing. We know from how people act that most people, not all, but most people are willing to take very high risk with a very small amount of money. And the reason we know they like to do that is because they buy lottery tickets. And the odds of them winning, as we know, are very, very low. So I'm not suggesting that putting all your money in equities is like buying lottery tickets, but I'm just suggesting that there's a different series of steps that people emotionally go through deciding how much risk they're willing to take and with how much of the assets that they have. So we come to a fork in the road about to put all of our money in at one time or to dollar cost average. And I have gotten a lot of feedback about that, because we made the point, Rich Buck and myself, in the article and in the podcast, that dollar cost averaging into the market is considered to be time diversification, because over time we know stocks are going to go up and down. We also know that the best time to put money into stocks is when they're down, when they're in trouble as a group, particularly when you have a diversified portfolio. But that's hard to do, and it's also hard to do when you inherit $1 million from Aunt Jane, and somebody says you should put in, let's assume, by the way, that that's money you're going to put aside for the future, for retirement many years from now. Somebody would say you should put that money all to work right now, because the studies show that in the long run, you will make more if you just put it all to work. Of course, some people in our industry will try to make the point that you should put it all to work in a load fund. You should put it all to work in a load fund that has high expenses. As a matter of fact, you should put it to work in a load fund with high expenses that the managers buy and sell often. And you know where I'm getting to here, and that is that the first thing they said is you should put the money all to work at one time. By the way, that always benefits the industry, because if we suggest you put the money in the market over a period of time, then we lose the time we would have made money off of all that money. If you put it in the market right now, we're maximizing our return off of you if we're managing your money. So there are a whole bunch of things you can do that are not in your best interest. I don't like the load fund idea. By the way, a load fund could turn out to be the number one fund in the industry. So who am I to say? Well, not likely, though. And the active management, not likely. And the high expenses, not likely to help you. You get the idea. You want to do the things that are probably going to work. And I do believe this. I believe that if somebody who's not an experienced investor is got some money to invest for some reason, it came all at one time, like it came from a pension fund and you decided to start managing that money on behalf of you and your family. Or it could come from a rollover from a 401k that you've been managing for years. Now, by the way, those are two different challenges in a way, because you see, if you have a portfolio that has been all equities in the 401k plan, and that's what you've lived with, and that's what you are betting the future on is the right thing to do, then when you roll that money over, transfer that money into an IRA or some account that you can manage it on behalf of yourself and your family, there really isn't any reason to dollar cost average in, because you've spent, let's say, a lifetime having all of your money in equities and really do understand the risk and have lived through 50% losses of your portfolio several times. On the other hand, if you're not an old, experienced investor and you all of a sudden have a large amount of money and you put that money in the market and it turns out to be the summer of 1987. In fact, several months before the market in one day declined by over 22% in one day, the market had already come down significantly, and it could have looked like the market wasn't all that risky because it had already declined. But there was another big decline in there that would have ripped your portfolio apart, and if you were not experienced, could likely lead to you just cashing out and concluding never again. And my concern is whether investors who find themselves with a bunch of money are going to have the opportunity of a lifetime to put that money aside and have it work for them and their families. And if, because the industry says it's the right thing to do, you got money and it's appropriate for equities, get it in now, because the odds are a year from now or 2 years from now, you're going to be ahead of dollar cost averaging into that equity position. And so it did not surprise me when I got people writing to me and saying, hey, you're giving people bad advice. If they've got money to invest, it should be in the stock market. And here is what one of our followers wrote to me, sent me an article mathematically demonstrating that dollar cost averaging into a retirement and getting long-term retirement money invested sooner rather than later gives you better return than waiting to invest. Now, they're right. They're right. Let's say there's a 70% probability that if you just put that all in there at one time, that you would come out with more money at the end of your life. Versus putting it in, let's say, over 2 years, dividing that money up and moving it into equities over a two-year period. I'm not saying you shouldn't put the fixed income money to work right away. That I don't have any problem with. But yes, during that period of time, there is some likelihood, and a pretty good likelihood, the market's going to go up. And so at the end of that 2 years of dollar cost averaging in, you can look back and say, Merriman gave me bad advice. But see, my concern for many of you is that if the first thing that happens and you dump all that money in is you bail out with a promise to yourself never to take that kind of risk again, because from time to time, more often than we would like, you're going to see a decline averaging about 30%. And it's about every 4 to 6 years you're going to lose 30%, which means, particularly right now, for example, where the market is very, very high, it won't surprise me to see that the market will go down significantly. And that if you dollar cost average, it's possible that you might, in fact, do better. But I'm concerned about how to keep from being massacred at the very beginning of the process, and massacred enough that you just don't want any more of that battle. And in this letter, it says, when you asserted that one should always dollar cost average a lump sum investment, you are incorrect, and that is not an opinion, but rather a fact. So, that historically, on balance, is a fact. But it isn't a fact always, whether you go back to 1929 or any of the years where, had you put all the money into the market immediately, that it would have been a bloodbath. And in fact, I gave an example many months ago about making a lump sum investment at the beginning of 1929, and by 1938, that money being worth about 60% less, $400 on $1,000 at the end of that 10 years. On the other hand, if you had dollar cost averaged into the small cap value, for example, then you would have actually, at the end of the 10 years, compounded your money at about 11% a year. So we cannot say it's a fact in terms of it always working for you, whether it's lump sum or dollar cost averaging. In fact, if there's a fact, the fact is it could be good for you, it could be bad for you. That's a fact if we look at history. But there are times that I think a lump sum investment is a good idea. And the reason I say this is because the amount of money you're going to do it with is not going to be a large amount. And that is when you are doing an IRA. If you have the money sitting in a savings account someplace on day one of a year, I would like you to dollar cost average into that IRA on the first day of the year. Let's say now it's a $6,000 maximum that you can put in, and you've got $6,000 sitting around. I want you to put it in the very first day of that year. And so your dollar cost averaging strategy is that you dollar cost average in on the first day of each year. But we are not talking about an amount of money that if the market does go down, that it's going to be a life changer for you. 6,000 versus 600,000 is emotionally a very different case. And by the way, I should mention, when we talk about IRAs, there are a lot of people, even though they've got money available, who don't make the contribution to their IRA until the last day they legally can. And they're rushing to find a place to get it to work because they've waited. That costs investors a ton of money. In fact, in essence, it costs you 1 year of returns by waiting to the last day rather than doing it the first day of each year. Actually, it's a little more than 1 year, because you could have done it on January, let's call it January 2nd of a year, as opposed to April 15th of the following year. It's a huge difference. So there's a case where I think dollar cost averaging actually works beautifully, but it isn't with a large amount of money. And the other thing we have to understand about dollar cost averaging is that it doesn't protect you against the market going down after you've done all of that dollar cost averaging. You could dollar cost average into a market that was either going up over that, let's say, 2 year period, or going sideways over that 2 year period, whatever it might be, after you've invested all that money and you got in and made some money along the way, then you could have the 30% decline or the 50% decline. You never are protected totally from the 50% decline unless you don't go in the market. So let me just, I want to restate what I'm thinking and make sure I don't encourage you to do something that's not in your best interest. First of all, there are all of these points in our investing career where we come to this fork in the road. As I said earlier, load versus no load, stocks versus bonds, investing early rather than waiting till you're older, automatically increasing the amount of money you put aside each year into your 401k. What that does to you over time, all of those things are heavily, probability-wise, in your favor. But where I get weak-kneed, and I want to be careful that I don't set people up for a lifetime of loss because I encouraged them to do something that came back and emotionally was so devastating that they just didn't have the trust in the market anymore. And that is things like how much you have in equities and fixed income. I am not in fixed income because I couldn't take a major loss in the market. I just know I would be devastated emotionally if I did that at this age. So about dollar cost averaging, and by the way, let me tell you why I feel strongly about dollar cost averaging large amounts of money. I have found that what happens in the first year of an investor's experience with investing has a huge impact on their commitment for the future. I remember putting a lady into an account, diversified account, and the loss of 0.5% the first month was enough to convince her this was not for her. And so there, I totally lost on that one because it had enough fixed income in the portfolio to address her risk tolerance. And by the way, she had She had declared that she had a lot more risk tolerance. In fact, she had declared that she was willing to lose up to 10 to 20% of her portfolio. But then she found a half a percent was enough to convince her this is too risky for her. So I know that when I gave advice to people as clients of my old firm, and if in the first year things went as planned, they had a very high likelihood of being an account for a very long period of time. But I also found that if you did not perform up to expectations in that first year, that there was a much higher probability that you would decide this strategy is not for me. And so when we think of the right fork in the road, the comparison to dollar cost average or lump sum is very different than the decision to go load or no load, or stocks versus bonds. And so I will admit that the odds are, if you lump sum everything you have to invest in the market right now, that 2 or 3 years from now, you'll more than likely be fine. But if, on the other hand, somebody sits with you and asks you the right questions about your experience, your risk tolerance, how you feel about loss, and sometimes with a couple, one person is really quite comfortable with loss. The other person doesn't like loss at all, thinks that investing is purely a gamble. And anything we can do to help those people who don't trust the market to experience it without having to take too much risk and lump sum investing, probably for those kind of people, it's just too much risk all at one time. They need to have their hand held and go through that process before they trust all those things that most of us people who've been around the industry know. We know what to expect, but there are a lot of people who don't, and their expectations, by the way, are often not right. They think the market has a very, very high likelihood of making them money over the first year. Yeah, about 25 to 30% of the years you'll lose money. And that's not a slam dunk to those people who just think that the odds are very, very high in their favor. And in my second topic for the day, I mentioned earlier in my comments about what's worked in the past, that small cap value has far outproduced either large cap value or small cap blend or large cap blend. Large cap blend being the S&P 500, some growth and some value, but very large companies. And so with small cap value, you have the premium of the small and you have the premium of the value that the academics have identified. I had a number of good questions from one of our listeners and I've answered before, but one I didn't answer because I wanted to talk to the horse's mouth on this one. And that is, the question is, when considering small cap value, how confident can you be with survivorship bias not influencing the results, especially the further in the past? And here's what's behind that question. When we look, I shouldn't say when we look, when the academics have looked at asset classes going back to 1926 to 28, they cannot see these investments. Like if you talked about the S&P 500, there was no S&P 500 in 1926. The S&P 500 prior to 1957 is purely hypothetical because it didn't exist. It is run today, as it has been since 1957, as by a committee. But there wasn't a 500, S&P 500 committee in 1926. But what the academics have done is they've gone back and created what they believe the S&P 500 would look like. And not all of those companies were able to survive the Depression, or maybe they didn't survive later in their career. A lot of companies do not survive the long term, and I've seen many of them fail in my lifetime as an adult, including Eastern Airlines, including WaMu, Washington Mutual. By the way, it doesn't mean that somebody doesn't pick these companies up and buy their assets, but the company, the stock that you might have had, is of no value in many cases. So, how valuable is that information? Well, if the academics who get this information and put it together look at every public company and then decide what group it goes in, growth or value, large or small, and they break it down into deciles in terms of the size of the company. So the first decile, the very largest companies, and the 10th deciles, the 10% of the companies that are the smallest. These companies were being tracked, have been tracked, 1 year at a time. And by the way, and this is what this gentleman is concerned about, is survivorship bias. If all you do is include in the long-term results the companies that made it, you are going to grossly overstate the long-term return. You've got to include, in order to give a realistic picture of the past, those companies that didn't survive. You have to reduce the value of the portfolio by whatever that value was. In other words, if you ended 1 year and that particular company was worth $2 million, and by the end of this year, they go broke and the company files, you know, Chapter 11 or 7 or something and is totally worth nothing to the shareholders, then that's a loss for the whole portfolio. You don't just get rid of that stock because it went out of business and ignore the fact that it lost all that money. These studies have taken those companies into consideration and deducted from the returns all of the losses represented by the companies that didn't make it. Now, that's not true in the mutual fund industry. And it's a good reason why you see the returns of mutual funds as a group over time is that when you look at Morningstar, at the average return of companies, mutual fund companies over 15 years, those are the returns based on the funds that made it and survived. Because if you included the funds that didn't make it, that got merged away or sold or whatever, however they went out of business, if you were to merge that return away, it will reduce the overall long-term return. And survivorship bias is a terrible problem to deal with. In the hedge fund business, something like 5% of the hedge funds survive after 10 years. So when you see the return of the hedge funds today over the last 10 years, you're not seeing the return, including all of those, the 95% that didn't make it. It's really very misleading. Now, that doesn't mean that somebody might not improperly represent a particular asset class. I'll give you an example. When I was an investment advisor, our firm was working with an investor from Spokane and was talking about the results that he had gotten with his previous advisor. And one of the things he noted that made him very pleased with the work that his advisor had done was that his advisor had told him that his firm had outperformed the S&P 500. And it turned out that that was true, except for one thing. The broker had not included the reinvestment of dividends. So if you owned the S&P 500, like the Vanguard S&P 500, you would have gotten a higher rate of return than he was showing, because the return with the Vanguard S&P 500 includes a reinvestment of all the dividends that you got. And what the broker was representing in Spokane was the return of the S&P 500 without the dividends. So yes, he had done better than the S&P 500 without the dividends, but he did worse than the S&P 500 if you included the dividends. But let me get back for a second to this gentleman's question regarding, and he was really focusing in on small cap value. And what do we know about small cap value versus the S&P 500? Well, we know, going back to 1928, that the S&P 500 compounded at 9.7%. That, by the way, does not include any expenses. And right now, as you know, probably you can get an S&P 500 fund or ETF with 0.05% expense. So the return would have been with expenses lower than the 9.7. But all of these numbers I'm about to share with you are do not include the operating expenses of a mutual fund to replicate these asset classes. But what we know about the small cap value from that same in that same period, 1928 to 2018, is that the small cap value compounded at 13.1. And if we look at the average 40-year period of the S&P 500, it's 10.9 versus 16.2 for small cap value, the average 40-year return. Now, 16.2 is an amazing return, and it would be easy to sell people on putting money into small cap value if you use that as your expectation. I don't, and the reason I don't does not have to do with survivorship bias. The reason I don't is because for many of those years, the liquidity of small cap value was very, very low, and the number of shares that were traded each year were very small. And so it had little to do with the market that we have today. Now, by the way, the fact that it had few shares to trade meant that when things were good, they were probably better than you would expect, and when things were bad, they were worse. So things have changed a lot since 1928. And if we only took the last 20 years, we would see that the small cap value advantage was not so different from the entire period, but what is different is over the last 20 years, I'm talking about 1999 through 2018, so we have full calendar years, that during that period of time, the S&P 500 compounded at 6.2%, and small cap value compounded at 11.8, that's using the DFA Small Cap Value Index. So there was a similar kind of difference. If we look again at the average 40-year period, 10.9 for the S&P 500 versus 16.2 versus 6.2 versus 11.8. So what small cap value did, it didn't come anywhere close to the 16% .2 average, but it did do appreciably better than the S&P 500. We have no idea how to know how important the last 20 years in the market has been. And by the way, there were some periods during that 20 years the market was fantastic, made lots of money. In fact, it includes the longest bull market in history. But the bottom line is still the same, 6.2% compound rate of return. And that's happened before. We've had a very long period of time where the market way underperforms expectations. In fact, for that 20-year period we're talking about, long-term government bonds made more money. So, what does that say about small cap value? Well, it says that the small cap value return going back to 1928 includes a very long period where there just wasn't much volume in the small cap value asset class. So you could have some volatility that was way outside what we would expect today. And so what we do know that makes us feel hopeful is that the small cap value will likely produce a premium over the S&P 500. We just don't know, first of all, what the S&P 500 is going to return, nor do we know how much that premium is going to be. But I have used, rather than a 16% return, I have, for small cap value, I've said, look, if we can get 12, that'll be great. A couple of quick questions here. Hi, Mr. Merriman. Thanks for the latest guidance. When you talk about distributions, is the procedure actually selling shares of funds in my IRA to obtain the money for living expenses? Well, the answer is it might be. I mean, what the distribution goes for is up to you, but all of those distribution tables are built to try to give you a sense of what you might have to live with in terms of volatility for different percentages of equity versus fixed income portfolios. But how you spend it, whether you spend it for taxes or to meet your cost of living or to do the wild and crazy things you want to do with a part of your money, depending on how the market does, those are really your choices. But for planning purposes, yes, we would normally be focused on wanting to make sure that at a minimum you have enough to meet your cost of living. And yes, you're going to have to sell some shares within your portfolio. Typically, what we would suggest people consider is in selling the shares, you use that as an opportunity to rebalance. So let's say, for example, that you're about to take your annual distribution and stocks have been doing a lot better than bonds. You would likely then take your equity positions, sell a portion of those to bring it back to as close as you can the right combination of fixed income and equities. And you might also want to include the payment of dividends and capital gains. Rather than reinvesting those, you might end up taking those out as a distribution. So my viewpoint, it doesn't matter where that money is going so much as what you can count on your portfolio to provide. And Bruce asks, he says he has a question about the web page, Paul Merriman's mutual fund recommendations for Fidelity. His question is, what do the three columns across the top, aggressive, moderate, and conservative, represent? I know what the words mean. I don't understand how they relate to each mutual fund. So the assumption is, with each of those three portfolios, one being aggressive, all equities, one being moderate, 60% equities, 40% fixed income funds, and then one being conservative, 40% equity and 60% fixed income. And so the theory is that to begin with, that one of these three combinations of funds represents your need for return and your risk tolerance. So if you have a conservative strategy that's 40% equity and 60% fixed income, we understand then that about you that you are a very conservative investor. And by the way, you can use those same mutual funds and configure them to even be less risky. You could make the assumption that the equity portion is only going to be 20% of the portfolio. That's up to you. I'm just trying to give some general guidelines here for the conservative, the moderate risk taker, and the aggressive risk taker. Now, the question is, what do you do about those percentages after you set up the portfolio with those percentages? See, first you have to decide how aggressive you're going to be, and then you can choose, if you wish, to buy the funds that I've recommended in the percentages I've recommended. But periodically, you're going to need to rebalance, theoretically, because if part of your money is in bonds because you've got it there to protect you against the impact of a loss in the stock market, that amount that you've chosen is going to protect you, not exactly, but reasonably, to keep you within a certain amount of loss that's likely to happen in that portfolio. For example, my wife and I, we have 50-50 stocks and bonds. So we believe that we will at some point lose about 20% having that amount in bonds. But as stock markets go up, we still own the same equity funds, but now we have more in stocks than we did when we started. So periodically, normally once a year, could be less, could be every 2 years, you go in and you reconfigure your portfolio back to your original asset allocation. Now, that may be that if stocks have gone up, you're going to be selling some stocks. By the way, you may be selling stocks to meet the cost of your distributions that you take out of there in order to rebalance. But ignoring those distributions, it would mean some money has to come out of equities and go into fixed income. And that's why we have those three levels of risk. And the theory, again, is you're going to get back to that exposure to risk from time to time. You don't want to try to manage it daily or monthly or quarterly. It's not necessary. You can rebalance once a year. You can rebalance once every 2 years. I just want to take a second to invite folks in the Seattle area, Seattle, Bellevue, Mercer Island area. On September 21, mark your calendar, I'm doing a 2.5-hour workshop for the AAII, and that will be happening at the Mercer Island Community Center. There is no fee to get in. They do ask for a donation, as they are a nonprofit organization, And while it's very cheap to have me come, oftentimes the folks that come have to fly in, and so these donations help cover getting some what I think are some really good speakers. So that's one on the 21st. On the 28th of September, I'm going to be doing a presentation. Not sure how long it's going to be yet for the Choose FI, Choose Financial Independence, local Facebook group. And hopefully this is going to be a lot of young people who are quite serious about trying to put their money to work and retire early. They are part of the, many of them, of the FIRE group, Financial Independence Retire Early. And I find them highly motivated to learn how to do better. So it's a thrill to have a chance to talk with that group. But I'll let you know later where that's going to be and what you need to do to get in. I'm sure it's free to get in, but I'm not absolutely sure. I'll tell you more about that next time that I talk to you. Thanks for listening, and I hope you're having a great summer.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.